On June 14th, 2012, Almakatsu came to Writer House to discuss writing the cross-genre novel. Interview by mystery author Meredith Cole.
I met Alma actually at the Virginia Festival of the Book, and what was very interesting was Nancy Damon had called me up and said, I really need you, I know I already have you on another panel, but I need you to do this panel. It's called Horror. It's a horror panel. And actually, I think the description was not horror. What was the description?
Obsessions and Conspiracies.
Right. So that was the title they came up with. So I was given four books, and none of them were actually that horror books. So I think this is actually a perfect segue to what we're talking about, which is how do people define what a book is and that sort of thing. And I think when you write a book like yours that is a little different than anything else, what are some of the pitfalls and what are some of the rewards that come with that? So, and I found your background, I mean, I went and sniffed around the internet, of course, to find all the gory details on the writers on my panel. And I just found your background so interesting. So what would you like to tell us about?
Probably what made it sort of interesting, too, is at the time I still had to hide what I did in real life. And so there was just like this big hole in, you know, if you thought about it, if you sort of read around it. Because a year ago today, not today, a year ago in 1 week, I had to resign from my career of 29 years with CIA. I was an intelligence analyst, senior intelligence analyst. These books have nothing to do with intelligence, as you'll find out. But I guess you could kind of take that differently, too. But just to give you a little background.
They're very intelligent books.
They're intelligence books. I say, you know, I tell people about my lifetime in intelligence, they just assume I write spy books, and they're not spy books, I guess is what I meant to say. But like probably everybody in this audience, I grew up wanting to be a writer. I was a reader when I was a little kid, one of those kids that lived in the library, just, you know, always had my nose in a book. And you know how it is, at some point, you think you want to give it a try. This is a pastime that just gives you so much pleasure. You want to see if you can do it too. And once I started doing that, and I was, 10, 12 maybe, I got it in my stubborn little head that I was going to be a novelist. And that's what I thought I was going to do. When I went to college, I got my undergraduate degree in literature and writing from Brandeis University. And then I realized there's no advertisements in the newspaper for novelists. And I ended up having this detour in the intelligence business. It wasn't what I thought I would do. I tested with the National Security Agency at the time. You couldn't hire enough mathematicians, there were even computer scientists, that sort of thing. So they tested you for aptitude. And I tested well, and they offered me the job. And I said, but I want to be a novelist. And they said, well, I'll come and I'll work for you for a few years, but I'm going to quit, you know. And they were like, fine, you just moved down to Washington, D.C. I was with them for 21 years. And then I went over to CIA for another 8 years. But eventually I got my chance. I stopped writing for a very long time. And it wasn't until I actually became very sick at 40 and thought, you know, not that I was going to die, but it looked like I was going to be able to go back to work, and it was a neurological problem. And I said, if there's one thing I want to do, I want to see if I can master writing. So that's what I wanted to do. I just wanted to see if I could write a book. No hope of ever getting it published. And like any intelligence analyst, I went back to school and got a master's degree once the neurological problem was resolved, and spent 10 years writing this book here, The Taker. But it had its origins in a short story that I wrote when I was in my 20s. That was a long time ago. Remember what I said about computers, right? That was a long time ago. So when some people read The Taker, they say, in some ways, it seems like not a book that would be written now. It seems like a book from 20 years ago or so, and that's why. Because the ideas for it, the characters for it, all came from a different time, and I'm going to bring up a little bit of that when we talk about some other authors who have written sort of genre-defying books. There's one from that period, too, that I think makes it understandable, makes what I'm talking about a little bit more understandable.
So when you sat down to write a book, did you have it in your head that you were writing any particular genre, or were you just still in the dream of, it's a novel, I'm going to see if I can finish it?
Well, it came, this particular book came from, as I said, a short story I wrote when I was in my early 20s. And at that time, like a lot of folks, I think, when you're that age, you know, I loved, what was then really considered horror. But, you know, fantasy, adventure. I wasn't a genre reader, though. I've always been a literary fiction reader. And anything that you would consider genre was something that I read when I was very young, you know, like in my teens or whatever. Once I went off to college, that was it. Mm-hmm. I studied with John Irving, you know, John Barthes, which are my favorite writers, about Vladimir Nabokov, you know, all that kind of stuff. I love foreign writers. So I knew I wasn't writing literary per se, but, you know, the story, it is what it is. And it grew out of this sort of fantastical, horrific story and went from there.
Wow. Now, I think that sometimes people get a little confused about genre, and they'll say to me, well, is, you know, what is the genre for this particular writer that they like? And the confusion often comes from the bookstores, because if you get to be a bestseller, they stop putting you in your genre. You become fiction. So despite the fact that Nora Roberts, for instance, is a romance writer, she is not necessarily under romance, so someone would find her under fiction. So then they'd be like, well, is she? Like, they have these questions. So there's a lot of things you can't actually control. And I had a friend who was published with Mira, which is part of Harlequin. She was writing mysteries, and she had 3 books in her series, and she went to a bookstore. The first book was in romance, the second book in her series was in mystery, and the third was in fiction. So if someone liked her writing, they would actually not be able to find all 3 of the books in the same series in that bookstore. So there's a lot of stuff you cannot control.
I think nothing. if you haven't been there already, that was like the biggest eye-opener. Just how incredibly crazy the publishing business is.
So we were going to start by actually talking about, is it different to write a cross-genre book, but is it different?
Well, I was thinking about this a lot as I was driving down here from Northern Virginia. So the first thing is, I think you end up with a book like this, you don't plan it. It's just the book you end up with. I don't think you can plan to write a book that's going to defy genres. If you did, it would come out just too stilted and weird, I think. It's, the book is what it is. And you know, and we'll get to this too.
Maybe it's too much like a television pitch or like a movie pitch where they're like, it's Die Hard meets Jaws or whatever. Right. And then someone's like, what? I don't understand what this would be like, you know?
Right. We had a terrible time trying to come up with log lines for this book.
Oh, no.
What did somebody say? Oh, somebody said, it's The Scarlet Letter meets Cold Mountain. Can you wrap your mind around that?
It's very much a women's book. It was very much a men's... Okay.
It's
all right.
Like weird as whatever. We obviously didn't use it. You know, I just see it on the back. So that's the first thing. I think, you know, but isn't that true of most writers and writing? It's the story's in you. It comes out. It is what it is. You can't really chisel it, shape it, squeeze it like Play-Doh into a mold to try to fit something. I mean, some people certainly do. But for it to be satisfying for you as a writer, it's the story is what it is, and then you just, especially something like this, you look at it and go, holy, what am I going to do with this book? So that was the first thing. And the second thing is, you know, when I was thinking about the topic, which is my fault because I picked it, I mean, in a way, we're kind of having a, kind of chasing ourselves around a tree. That was a bad metaphor. I blame my mother, by the way, because I'm half Japanese. My mom is Japanese, native from Japan, came to America after the war. Her English is atrocious. She cannot do metaphors or similes, so I'm always screwing them up. I blame her. Why not? She's my mother. So one thing I was thinking, though, is really what we're talking about is sort of the absence of a thing, and you can't really define something by absence. You know, we're talking about really books that don't fit a particular genre. But then when you think about that question, well, what is a genre anyway? I mean, there's a whole range of books within a particular category.
Well, let's back up, because that's actually an excellent point. Because I think maybe people don't actually understand what are the positives and negatives of going for a certain genre. And I came from screenwriting, and so when I set off to write a novel, I had tried literary fiction, and it was like you're in someone's head, and pages go by, and nothing happens, you know. And I was like, this is not very compelling for me. And when a friend suggested I should write a mystery novel, I sat down and I realized, it's just like a screenplay, and it's got Act 1, Act 2, Act 3. Act 1, you kill somebody. Act 2, you try to figure out who it is. Act 3, you figure out who it is. And that is the way a screenplay is set up. I can do that. And it actually went, and I had something to do, so anytime anything was slow, you have your person nearly get hit by a car. You have something, you can have something to happen. So it was very useful. So that's an advantage to writing to a genre. The same thing is probably with a romance. I've never tried to write one.
Me neither.
But I imagine that is exactly the same thing. Things are getting slow. Well, let's throw in another complication.
Yeah.
You know, and that you're, because you've got a driving arc to your story, which is your romance or your mystery. But one of the things we started talking about was one of the things that's really interesting, because to people who, when I talk about romance to them, because I have read romances, and if someone says to me, well, I've never read a romance or whatever, I'll go, well, give one a shot, because you know what, you might actually learn something from it, because I think every great book has mystery and romance in them.
Right.
And then also undefinable stuff, maybe that's that cross-genre thing, that you don't, you know, because there are wonderful mystery writers who write...
Right.
Set in Japan, or set, you know, in New York City, or set, you know,
yeah,
in primitive times. You know, they're all different, and that informs the writing as well.
And within any genre, there's that whole range from, you know, just really superlative writing that maybe kind of defies what you think of as genre, all the way down to, you know, extremely formulaic, et cetera, et cetera. So, not explain this very well. Let me back up a little bit. So with Hopkins, they teach you the difference between literary and commercial fiction. One is plot-driven, one is character-driven.
Mm-hmm.
And they teach you the four elements of any that you should have in any book, which I know I'm going to screw up, right? It's voice, theme, character, and I forget what the other one is. It might be story.
Long words.
But, and long words. But any great book has all those elements in it. It doesn't matter if it's commercial or literary. It's going to have great characters. It's going to have a distinctive voice. If it has a theme, hopefully it's not being used like a big club and beating you over the head and shoulders and being obvious about what the theme of the book is. You know, it's about man's freedom and man's inhumanity to man. You know, people don't want to read that. They want that to come through in the writing. And then, of course, you know, the story has to be good and compelling and in being told in a unique way. That's where the other components come in. So, just to give you an idea, you know, when I first started writing in the program, I was meeting with editors and agents. A lot of them were trying to, would steer us away from writing literary fiction. And this was right about the time when literary fiction really just is a very difficult sell. To the point where today I think a lot of literary fiction you read is a lot more plot-driven than it used to be.
Mm-hmm.
You don't get a lot of that meandering man alone in his head with his thoughts stuff anymore. It just doesn't sell.
Right. Well, but that's also, I mean, the interesting thing is, what is commercial fiction? I think it's books that sell. Right? That actually people want to read. And I mean, and so you'll have people who are like, well, I am published by this extremely small press, you know, and no one's actually heard of it. And somehow I'm elevated because they've only published 1,000 copies of my book that are now collector's items. But at the heart of it, I think every writer wants to be read. So you could say there are some amazing literary writers that are rather popular. Does that make them disdainful? You know, because now they're popular? Or, you know, that kind of thing. I think it's an interesting sort of mix to it.
And we're at an interesting time, too. So, like, one of my favorite literary authors is John Banville. And if you know John Banville, he also writes commercial fiction mysteries under the name Benjamin Black.
Mm-hmm.
He wrote Christina Falls and Silver Swan, I think, and Elegy for April, Elegy. I started losing interest in his books after the first couple. The first few Benjamin Black books were wonderful, and then after that, you know, anyway. But I mean, it makes a great case. A great writing makes for a great book, whether it's at the literary end of the spectrum or more of a commercial end. So this book is considered commercial, but a lot of people have said that it is very literary. The writing is a little bit denser. You know, I really put a lot of thought into the craft crafting of the book, that sort of thing. So while on one hand it's commercial because it has, you know, supernatural elements in it and things that most literary...
And it's got, you know, face on the cover. And
yeah, the covers, while very lovely, really don't
have... Mine has no face.
Does not have a face.
Yeah.
It's a very difficult book to market. And we were going to talk about marketing. Cause
the second part, yeah.
The second part. We're going to start to talk about craft and, like, what the difference was. You know, how is craft any different when you're writing something that sort of crosses genres? And then we're going to talk about the marketing.
But I think what we've come to the conclusion of is great writing is great writing. And great writing can be in genre, literary fiction. And literary fiction is considered somewhat of a genre, too. But I think the thing for me when I teach writing is you need to be clear about what you're doing. Because that's the thing I think, I've had writers, I've judged contests, and they will literally write, what is the genre? It is a cozy thriller, romantic suspense. And there'll be like four things written on there. I'm like, well, pick one. What is it mostly? What is it mostly? And maybe you feel like it's undefined. But what is it mostly? Because as I said before, I think every great book has some mystery in it, has some romance. That's the stuff that keeps, you know, things going. We want to know what's going to happen. We want to know, are they going to get together? All that kind of stuff. But you have to maybe know. You have to go with intention because you have to think about a reader because a reader picks up your book and thinks, I'm going to get X.
Well, that's
some of it you can't control. I mean, going to the marketing, which is, she did not pick this cover.
Yeah, we'll talk about all the marketing stuff.
I sort of suggested something similar with my cover. Not exactly. I always had lovely things with my cover, but with my first cover, they said in your contract, they said you have some say in your cover. And they send you your cover, and I said I don't understand what this type is, and I'm not sure. I don't have a cover here, but I don't. I'm not sure what this thing is. Is it a bullet or a camera? But you know, a scope or what? And I thank you. And they didn't change it.
Right.
So and it was like, okay, well, you know, I wasn't offended, but I just said, well, I see. It's you get to look at it.
I forget what the word is. So there's two levels on covers. John can help us out here if we screw up. The one level is, it's not approval. Approval is,
When Nora Roberts and James Patterson.
Yeah, say, and sure, the first one is just, I can't remember. They just show it to you, basically. And you say, thank you very much.
Book doesn't have a puppy in it.
there are no red feathers in the reckoning. I hope you won't be disappointed.
There are some books that they all look the same. I think it's Kensington.
Yeah.
And they're pink, and they have puppies on them or kittens, and the women are always wearing stilettos, despite the fact that your character might just be wearing Birkenstocks or whatever. Right. It doesn't matter. That's just the style.
I just had a very irate email from a reader in England because in the British cover of the book, they went for a total Lauren Kate ripoff, I think her name is. You know, the young adult writer who has... They're beautiful covers, but the girls in the... Not, they all have girls in ball gowns, but she was one of the earliest ones with the long black hair. They used a photo from that photo shoot, which they then doctor up to look like artwork. So the heroine... I mean, the figure on the cover has black hair, and the woman in the book has blonde hair. So this British person just ripped me up one side and down the other for having a brunette on the cover. And I just wrote back and said, thank you. I mean, I have no say over the cover. And I brought that up to the publisher, and they were like, well, I think readers understand that it's projection or whatever. So we can move on to the marketing side of things. There was one thing I meant to say. Gosh darn it, I know. Oh, so one of the things we did talk about is really there seems to be sort of two approaches on craft. And one is, like you said, that sort of the very conscious choice that maybe you're combining genres that you enjoy, and so you're making this conscious decision where you're maybe going to respect some of the conventions of the genres and maybe bend some, but, you know, it's this conscious decision, and you know where the rules are in the genre that you're working with.
And we had some specifics with some people.
Like Charlene Harris.
Right. And I don't know if people know True Blood or not. It's a little television show. But Charlene Harris was a very, very successful, not very successful. She was a mid-list mystery author for many, many years. And I don't know how many she wrote in her, is it Agatha Raisin?
Yeah.
Or am I getting her confused with someone else? Anyway, she has like a librarian as her assistant. Mm-hmm. So she hit this point where she realized, I'm never going to sell more. maybe if I combined genres, I would get both audiences. So it's like vampires and mystery. And that's the rest is history. Yes. And I think it took a while for it to catch on.
It did.
But I think someone had to take a slight risk with that because they're a little bit, humorous. They have a lot of things going on in them.
And they really kicked off this whole new genre, although I think it did take the success of the TV show to really validate what she was doing. And then as it got more and more popular and all of her books just hit the New York Times bestseller list, then publishers were like, okay, let's...
And she is hilarious. She said when she figured out, I think it was Alan Ball was doing the show, and after she signed all the contracts, and I think it was right when she realized that it was actually going to be a big deal, she was like... Oh my God! I can't go to church anymore because they were pretty. I think actually she read the script and they're very sexy, right?
Yes, right. I loved her. Blood is so campy. It is so funny.
And if you see her, she looks like
she's a sweet Southern woman.
Yep,
with the hair.
With the hair.
She looks dressed in costumes at the conferences.
Does. She's done whatever. Yeah, so anyway, it's...
So that's one type. Another author that some of you guys may know of that we were trying to come up with examples is Carlos Zafon Ruiz. He's a South American writer, but his books are very popular here. He wrote The Angel Game and before that, Shadow of the Wind. And they're very much a combination of sort of horror and fantasy, and it has a little mystery to it. But he also writes young adult books as well. And he's a great example of someone who really respects all of the genres that he draws from. But then we're also talking about the sort of iconoclastic, people who just go in and sort of break the rules or just don't pay attention to the rules. And so one of my favorites here is Diana Gabaldon. I don't know if any of you guys have read Outlander or any of her other books. So I started reading her through the Lord John Grey series, which are more like straight historical mystery and suspense. And then I started getting these comparisons to Outlander with The Taker. And I thought, I knew what it was about. Very weird mashup of science fiction and historical, where a woman from, I can't remember if it's World War II.
It's right after World War II, I believe.
Ends up slipping through this crack in time and shows up in 16th century, 17th century Scotland, something like that. Maybe 17th century, maybe 18th century, sorry.
We read them very closely.
So it was this weird mashup of, historical...
And romance readers read them.
So this was the shocking thing when I read it. I thought she would be a bit more respectful of genre boundaries, but it really isn't. There's a lot of historical content in it, and she does that very well. There's a lot of sex, quite frankly, and romance. It's a very dark book. There's long, long passages describing different ways to flog people and how the skin falls off their back. And rape and torture.
I think that's when she lost me.
And all that kind of stuff. But what surprised me is, I don't know if, and maybe somebody in the audience knows, I'd certainly be interested in finding out, did anybody mention how dark that book was when it comes out? Because nowadays you only hear that it's historical and it's romance, and all the rest of it is sort of glossed over. And I was just really surprised by that.
By how dark it was. Yes. That's really interesting. But also
it's 20 years old.
Right, and that's the other thing. I think before, also, you may have to go back pretty far, but before a certain time, books didn't have a genre. I read, one of my favorite books still is Rumor Garden, Green Gage Summer. And reading that again as an adult, I realized this would be YA.
Huh.
But it deals with a lot of adult issues. But your character is a kid. So therefore... And I don't think people understand that anymore, but that's what the publishing industry does. If you have a main character that's a child, they will immediately say, this is YA.
Right.
Whether you wrote it thinking it's a mystery or it's a fantasy.
Unless it's really, unless the writing is really at a level where children are not going to get it, or it has some really dark pieces that just can't be exercised out of it. But,
But then they might ask you to change that.
Yeah.
So that's the other thing, too. Yeah.
So let me make sure we haven't missed anything really good. Oh, and Andre Neffenegger, I think, is another example in here where How many of you guys have read The Time Traveler's Wife? Well, you really should. It's great. But if the time traveling part is, you know, you think it's going to be like this weird science fiction book, but it isn't. I mean, the science fiction-y element is just so by the boards, really. It's the, you know, the thing that really blew me away. I remember when it came out, I was going to on a business trip to Norway for the first time. Never been to Oslo before. I ended up staying in my hotel room every second I could reading this book because she handles, like, the complexity of time. You know how you always have to have your reader grounded in time and space and place in the book? And then this, they're all over the place, you know, age, when they meet each other, incredibly complex, and I was just riveted trying to figure out how she kept track. Took her 10 years to write that book, too.
Oh, I see.
But, you know, so she's another example of someone who just breaks the conventions, you know, so science fiction readers would not think to read her. I don't think women fiction readers would have thought to read her. She was a real word-of-mouth sensation. She was first, the book was turned down by publishers left and right, a very small literary press, McAdam Cage published her, and it took about a year or so, I think, for the book to take off, and then it just went blockbusters.
And we should bring up with marketing the whole issue that the internet brings a whole new thing. I mean, I there was a big awakening for me because my first book came out in 2009, and they were still sending their covers to Barnes & Noble for approval. St. Martin's was, which I found really... They still do?
They still do.
And it's interesting because it's like, what part of the market do they have to be to have them still have that, like... Because they literally would send some books back, and they would say, it has to get a new cover because the Barnes & Noble buyer didn't like the cover.
I think marketing is really the crux. And so, you know, we were talking a little bit earlier, and we can certainly open up the discussion because I'm sure people are really interested in this, like the break between, you know, when is it worth going the traditional publishing route, or should I be thinking about self-publishing because, you know, with technology, it's just sort of changed all of that. But in either case, so that enables you to write the kind of story you want to write. But no matter what you do, you're still going to have this incredible marketing hurdle. And it might feel a little less so on the self-publishing side, but when you have a cross-genre book, a traditionally published book, the marketing is just crucial. And after almost a year now with my first book being out, I would strongly recommend that if you can put your book in a genre, you put your book in a genre. Because so much just really rests on it. And if readers have a hard time figuring out what your book is about, they're not going to pick it up. They're not going to read it. And it just, I made a whole list of all of the things that are, you know, not only is it going to affect what shelf you're going to be in the bookstore. And this is once we get past all of the, you know, are you going to be comped, so you're going to be in the front of the store. And I'm not talking about that. I mean, when the dust settles later on, where are they going to be sticking your book? But you need to know who your comps are, what titles are comparable to you, who are your peers. That information is really important, not only for how your publisher is going to position the book, and they're going to ask you what are the comps for your book. But as you start to market your book, because a lot of it is going to fall on you too, and you start thinking about, okay, what book festivals am I going to try to get into? What conferences? What writers' organizations should I belong to? Because networking is very important. You have to understand who your peers are. So the problem with this book is that it covers so many genres. You know, I feel like I belong to all of them. I belong to none of them. There's no writers that are very close. And I belong to Horror Writers of America. Actually, I just pulled out of that one. Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers, Mystery Writers of America, International Thriller Writers, Romance Writers. I do, because there's a little bit, and they've all embraced the book. They all say, that's fine.
But see, that's also an advantage, then, that we're talking about. And we started talking, too. I was like, since I'm heavily involved with the mystery community, I can say myself and many of the people that I know read outside the genre as well. So mm-hmm. It's not like, you know, they also read science fiction, or they all, you know what I mean? So they don't, so I think you're going to get, hopefully you're going to get a wider audience.
Well, it is, I've found it's been a little difficult, partly for what you experienced at the Virginia Festival of the Book, that I end up getting on these hodgepodge kind of things that, you know, it doesn't really quite fit into. But but don't, I mean, I don't mean to sound like I'm whining here. I'm just trying to give you advice. So if you've got one of those books that seems to span a couple genres, really think long and hard if there's a way you can sort of move it more to one genre or the other. Because just in so many ways, it is going to make your life so much easier.
You don't mean mine. Pick one. What's it mostly?
Right. What's it mostly? So what would you say? What's it mostly? Historical?
That's a good question.
Yeah, if you read the book, you'll see. So
I think that there's room for that. I don't think everything has to be a genre book. If there's a fiction, as you were talking about, commercial fiction. If two of the genres are literary fiction and commercial fiction, I think that there's more room.
I think when the publishers acquired it, they saw it more in the. Well, first of all, it gets compared a lot to Anne Rice, early Anne Rice. Like Interview with the Vampire and the Mayfair Witches. But it's not a traditional horror because it doesn't have like vampires or witches or any of that kind of stuff. So it wasn't horror in that way. But it has the historical element and it has a love story, but it's not a romance. It's not a happily ever after. It's a very dark, it's supposed to be a cautionary tale, which are not so popular these days. So it has all of these different elements, and it has this, like I said, the supernatural element, and you can't take one out. It's like a three-legged stool. You take one leg away, and it just sort of totters. It needs all of those, but yeah. It's made it very hard to sort of convey to people.
And you are also having another challenge, and we're going to open up to questions, but the whole challenge of having a trilogy in which you always are concerned with not revealing, which I think would make it very hard to pitch.
It is, especially since when you get to the end of the book, then you really understand what the mystery throughout the whole thing is about. And, yeah, honestly, I'll tell you the God's honest truth. So when the book went sold at auction, and it actually sold to two publishers, it's Random House Overseas and Simon & Schuster in the U.S. I'm not rich. This was right around the time when the big advances, the market fell. So... I can't complain, I'm not rich. And they just saw it as it was going to be, you know, it was going to appeal to the Twilight audience, the older Twilight audience, because it is a dark story. Or, you know, The Passage was very big. It's that sort of, that niche area where it's sort of literary, supernatural, paranormal, metaphysical. It really is a very metaphysical book. And they just thought it was a slam dunk, and I don't think they worked on the market. Tell you the truth, they just thought it would happen. So, like, if you hold up that cover,
yeah, mine has no pigs, but I like this cover. But
what? Let me ask you. So, what does it tell you though? When you look at that cover, what does it say to you? What kind of
spooky,
book do you think?
Spooky gothic. That's what I expected.
Yeah,
only like 50 pages in, but and I love it so much.
Oh, thank you.
She's got her at the first book. Exactly.
Yeah, but I'll just say one quick thing. On the way up, I was asking her, what is this book about? What's it about?
Yeah.
And I heard they lived 300-400 years. Right? So all the other stuff, I was like, that's interesting. So
okay.
Whether it's romance or all that, but I wanted to figure out how they would live 300 to 400 years. So that part got me. Right? So I don't know if they drink something or if they're a spell. I don't know what you do, but I thought that was unique.
It was cool.
With no vampires.
But no vampires.
Mortal,
no
right?
Vampires.
How do they do it?
Yeah.
I can tell.
I'm reading a Joyce Carol Oates short collection of short stories at the same time. They seem to go together really well.
Oh, really?
I have four kids, so I like short stories to sit in the, you know, dentist's office while I'm with.
That's
I don't, you know, like to interrupt a long book while I'm, you know, I like the little nuggets. So, but they're very similar in feel, which is really
interesting. Which collection of short stories is it?
The one with the man in the sort of trench coat walking through the woods. I can't think of the name of it right now.
I'll have to look for it. I remember the cover.
It's a collection of short stories that are quite spooky and very difficult to define what they're about. There's one about a woman whose husband died, and she becomes attracted to a man in a grocery store who seems retarded with a pumpkin head. I mean, it's very strange. But they're very different from
right.
The story, but they're very spooky. And so I just coincidentally started reading that from a short story, and it has a very similar feel to it.
Oh, that's Well, I think there was a time when this, what some people call slipstream fiction, was very popular, where it's sort of fantasy, it's sort of horror, it's that otherworldly feeling, like when you're in a dream state and you just kind of know things are not quite right. It's called slipstream fiction. There's actually a convention called ReaderCon that goes on in July every year. Some of my favorite writers are in this category. Peter Straub.
Is Murakami with...
Yeah, Murakami's almost in a class by himself. I read Wind Up Bird Chronicles.
That's an amazing book.
Yeah.
But it's very weird.
John Crowley, who's a professor at Yale, a writing professor there, he wrote a seminal book called Little Big. Came out about 10 years ago. Which, excellent. So I kind of feel like I'm in that category, but some people feel like I'm not slipstreamy enough.
Slipstreamy, not slipping around enough?
It will by the third book, it's very magical, very crazy.
Well, let's open up to some
irritating?
Questions. Oh, I'm sorry. Let's open up to some questions.
Do you find it irritating that an agent or a publisher wants to change? Is it necessary to do that to a writer, though? I mean, you are who you are, so why do they want to know who you're like?
Because they have to sell it.
Yeah.
It's a business.
It's a marketing thing.
And to appeal to other readers. Coming out as a debut, and we have other authors who've been through that horrible thing, can talk about it too, but it's just getting that first book out and just getting your name out there and starting to be known is so hard. And so anything they can do, I think, to make it easier to say it's a read-alike. So this poor baby has just been through the mill, and that's how we ended up with this cover. If anyone has seen the arc for this book, you'll know it was a completely different cover. It was, God only knows, it was like a fire.
I was going to say flame.
And a bottle in the front, and part of a window, and a house does burn in the book, but you wouldn't be able to tell it from the cover, and it had the signature gold scroll on it. And then, because the book is sexy but not erotica, I mean, it's like dark and kind of disturbing in a way, they said, let's try to market it to the 50 Shades of Grey crowd. So we had this cover change.
Oh, it's
so
the 50
that hopefully.
Shades
right, of Grey. Except, and it actually got picked up a lot. We got mentioned in USA Today, we got mentioned in Barnes & Noble blogs, we got mentioned in quite a few, because Simon is very persuasive. My publisher, but what they were trying to say is there is a bit of this sort of dominant submissive relationship going on between the two main characters, but not in the BDSM kind of way that 50 Shades of Grey is. So while people said, oh, this looks kind of interesting, it's sort of this literary 50 Shades of Grey. Unfortunately, it didn't sell like 50 Shades of Grey. But then once they read The Taker, they were like, this is nothing like 50 Shades of Grey. So
that's another problem if your publisher decides that you're in some kind of genre that you don't really fit, that people do get disappointed. And that's why I always say from the very beginning, you need to communicate yourself what you think you are. The best you can, because they're going to be trying to sell you. And if you know what the audience is, if this is a genre that you actually read, that's always very, very helpful that you're trying to write it, because then you know what the conventions are. You know, I mean, I'm always amazed when people who say, I'm writing a cozy, and they've got swear words and sex, and you know, those are
right.
Those are things you can have as much violence as you want. But don't say a cuss word, because you're going to get in trouble. Yes.
To either one of you, when you're writing and you're doing cross-genre, I agree with what you're saying about a good story has different elements, mystery and romance and so forth, but when you're doing your writing, do you ever see yourself, even in your editing process, being pulled too far in one direction to say, ooh, I'm getting carried away and it's getting off track and I need to move it back into some sort of mainstream, or do you just like letting it go?
That's an interesting question, because the thing is, all three books are a little different, too. This book is very historical. Most of it is telling the story of this woman's life, how she got from being an ordinary person to being made immortal. And it's really a curse. So you follow her through her misspent youth. And then the second book, I don't know how much to give away. So at the end of this, there's a man who made her immortal, a very mysterious man, and you don't know where he gets his powers from. Ooh, I'm going to ruin this for you.
It's okay. I'm going to read it anyway.
Well, if you've read anything about the book, you know the at the ending, she has to stop him, but he's immortal. You cannot kill him. You cannot even hurt him. How do you stop somebody who's immortal? So she,
you have to read the book to find out.
Well, you do, but at the beginning of this book, he gets out of the trap that she put him in, and now he's coming for her. So this is very much a chase book. She is trying to get away from him. He is coming after her. And you learn more about their backstories. You learn, I'll just leave it at that. And then the third book is the most sort of mystical and magical of all of them. And the secret of his powers, where his powers come from and why all this is happening, is revealed in the third. So for me, I've had the luxury of actually getting to write three different kinds of books. And so, I had it very clear in my mind, this one was going to be more historical.
But if you saw yourself getting too mystical in the first one, did you have to draw some of that, pull some of that out?
I wish I were that organized. No.
For the pacing and...
Yeah. As a matter of fact, this book was written as a standalone. It was written, it took me 10 years to write, I thought this was going to be it. And then at the end of it, we spent 10 years with characters, they're like family. And while I was waiting for the edits to come back, I said, to my agent, I can think of a way to extend the story. And I told them, they said, yeah, let's sell it. Of course they're going to say that. Let's sell it.
Great idea.
So, the first book was pretty much just written, and I didn't really have to worry about pulling back or doing this. It was what it was. And so then when I sat down to write two and now three, I did have a pretty clear idea of where it was going to go. So, yeah, probably not so much.
But I think if you, as a reader, have ever been in a situation where you're reading a book that's like a thriller, for instance, and suddenly you're like, oh my God, it's going so slow. That's probably an indication that the person is going on far too long, developing a relationship or telling you about every single thing about every building on this Parisian street. And you know what they need to do? They need to get back into the thriller, because that's what you're reading. You didn't pick this up thinking you were going to read a historical tract about Paris. You didn't think, that you want something delivered to you. And that's, I think, what the issue really happens with.
I think, yeah, and I would hope that whatever you write, no matter how many different types of elements of different genres you have a consistent voice and style that is carrying you through. So does that help?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, good, thanks. Can I pose a test case?
Well, not too long of an example, but you have a question.
I
she'll be here afterwards too,
yeah,
to talk, and she's going to be signing books. So.
Okay.
So, but if you have a question, I don't want to discourage you from asking a question. Did you have a question?
Sure, yeah.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
We have a People's Choice Award nominee in the audience.
Yes, we do. I hope you'll all vote for me.
Say your name and book.
John Mulligan Thompson, The Reservoir.
Which is fabulous.
It's used to go on the Library of Virginia site.
Yeah.
And just vote.
And
then
just
you can read it later.
Yeah. Just don't vote for David Kobachi. He's had enough award.
You'll be glad you did. I was just curious what, when you're drafting, is there any particular genre you like to read when you're kind of stuck and need to get yourself going, or do you just not like to read anybody else at all when you're, drafting your own thing?
I love to read other writers. I know some writers say that they won't read while they're writing, and I don't know how they can do that, really, because for me, that's like refreshing my brain. That's like giving it oxygen and, letting it play, letting it go out and play. So what I do, though, is I worry a lot about the book I choose. It has to really be good writing. If it's crap, I just can't read it, and I'll put it down. So it's a little hard. I'm trying to think, what am I reading right now? Well, I just picked up Hide Me Among the Graves by Tim Powers, who's another kind of cross-genre writer. I have to say I'm a little disappointed with it. It's a little disjointed, so I'm going to have to stop.
I feel like I read a lot of nonfiction.
Mm-hmm. Do you? While you're... Is it directly for your book that you're working on?
No, I'll just... That's my... I have to read. Like, I'm one of those people, it's like, I panic if there's going to be a long line at the post office and I don't have a book in my bag.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm like, what am I supposed to do? You know, like, talk to people? I don't know.
So, you have to just take out your cell phone.
But I will definitely go through phases, and it might also be when I'm having an issue with a plot where I cannot read in my own genre for a period of time. And I'll pick up books by authors I love, like Laura Lippman, and I'll be like, ugh, I can't even read this. And I'll realize, no, it's you. It's not the book, it's you. And so I'll have to walk away. But I think it's also if you're trying to deal with certain plotting issues, if someone's probably doing it well, you're disgusted because it's not going well for you. And if they're doing it badly, you can see all the wires and all the things exposed. You go, oh my God.
That's the crappy thing about becoming a writer, right? Is that you just analyze reading and it sucks the joy out of it. And that's why...
Oh, it's the best friend who's rather funny, you know.
Yeah, right.
Oh, I've seen that device before.
That's why I just am so happy when I find a book that really transports me, you know, that you just stop analyzing it. It just, you just love
and
reading
you don't
it.
Go to bed because you have to finish it. That's always wonderful. Yeah. You had a question back there?
Yeah, could you comment a little bit more about working festivals and writer groups in the multi-genre way? What do you do different and how do you do it?
That's a good question. I try to, I hope, if I'm on a panel with someone else, I try to rig it, actually. I'll try to see if they'll get somebody that I know works really well. For instance, I did the Maine Book Festival, and I really lucked out because they paired me with a woman who writes YA, but also would be considered sort of paranormal, you know, fantasy. But she also writes kind of dark for YA. And she's also a reporter for the Portland Phoenix, so she had a huge amount of followers. Yahoo! But, no, we were friends, and so I said, would you please put us together? And it was just great, because then we could really talk about, you know, what we saw was new and supernatural, and the difference between supernatural and gothic. You know, you just have much more meaningful conversations. I'm trying to think where it hasn't gone well. But, so yeah, I try to stack the deck. Oh, gosh, I went to RT Book Lovers Convention in Chicago this year, which is a huge festival, and for writers in the house, it's a great one to go to because, you know, a lot of book festivals, you don't get that many readers. This, you get thousands of readers that show up. But I'm not really romance, and somehow I got lumped in with mystery, and I was on a panel of wonderful mystery writers, but I don't really write mysteries. That was a little tough.
Yeah.
And take your lumps.
Yeah, and I also think that it's also confusing because I think people will think of a genre as a lump. And it's not a lump. It's all these different parts. And people will read certain kinds of mysteries, for instance.
Okay.
Or certain kinds of romances, but they're not going to read all of them. So you might get lumped with something that doesn't have fit at all, even if you are a genre fiction.
I think romance is definitely.
There's the really hardcore erotic all the way to the, like, I'm not making this up, Amish.
Yes. So here's a funny thing. When I came down to do Virginia Festival of the Book, right, I had just made fun of Amish romances in a blog post I did. And
you ran into one.
I walked into the Barnes & Noble, and there was a woman in the full outfit standing at the new fiction table.
She was probably
like
a Mennonite.
Right.
Because she couldn't even get in there in the horse and buggy.
Right. I mean, she was a Mennonite. But I was just like, holy shit, she's going to heckle me.
She's going to heckle you.
Anyway, so just to make clear, I didn't want to go to the romance community because this is not a romance. Romance has conventions, happily ever after, blah, blah, blah. But a lot of romance readers are broad readers, too. They don't just read in the genre. So at first, we got a lot of pushback. But I have to say, the romance community has really been very kind to me, really embraced me and helped support the book, even though it's not a standard, you know, romance book. So
the cover to me is very young adult. The other one's sort of very twilighty too. But we have two teenage girls, so we
see a lot of those books.
Yeah.
I have a friend who's a YA writer, and she would just, every time her covers would come out, it was like this whole thing, and she's like, so I've got the clear curtain, you know, I've got the curtain and the kit, and then what's this mean? And she's not showing her face.
Yeah.
You know, this whole thing is like all these conventions, and they all tend to look very similar. When Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants came out, then there was all the books that everyone just had someone's, you know, half of them cut off, you know.
When they asked me, so what do you see for your cover? I thought very much more historical. Oil painting, you know, da da da. And they were like, you're not getting any oil painting. You're not historical.
That's a penguin. reissued Jane Austen.
Yeah, I mean, I tell you, it's so hard. That cover we fought over. The original version was, the picture was the same, but it had the taker in red foil and no swirls. And I said, could you make it look any more like a vampire book?
There's
no vampires. People will have expectations. And they pushed back. I have to say they're probably right. We probably should have made it more clear-cut horror. I said, can you make it a little more feminine? And that's how the scrolls got in there.
Or you could just put a vampire in it.
To me, it fits so far from what I've written. It looks very gothic.
Oh, thank you. It is. It's a very gothic story. Yes, that's the other thing. You know, but it's almost like you can't win for losing.
Right.
Because there are people who go, you know, there's such a backlash in certain stratas of the you know, publishing industry against vampires and werewolves and all that stuff. I don't know if you know the book The Last Werewolf came out about the same time I did last year, which was written by a very literary writer. He had done like 8 literary novels. He said, screw this. I'm sorry.
Oh, sorry, I'm a little late.
You know, I'm going to write something more commercial. I haven't read it yet. I understand it's a wonderful book. But I sat in, you know, writers' conferences, having editors, agents, whatever, go, I'll be damned if I'm going to read that book. It has werewolf in the title. You know, even though it was, so you get that backlash thing, and
I know, but then it's like everyone says something's over. And I think that's the other thing. If you just, I mean, whatever, your book, your dream book is writing an Amish romance, and everyone has told you that Amish romance is so over, you know, don't listen to that, because by the time you finish the darn book, it took you 5-10 years, it'll be back, you know. So don't worry, things will come circling around again, because, like, I remember coming out and everyone was like, the PI novel is dead, and then it would come back because someone would write a really great one. And that's a thing too, and I always try to say this to writers who are interested in being published. The best thing to think about in terms of the publishing industry is that don't think of agents as people who just get their rocks off rejecting you, because that is a really bad trap to be in. And those are people that went and they're making horrible salaries. I mean, I would be shocked if anyone makes over $30,000 in some of those jobs. They make horrible salaries, but they do it because they love books. And their dream is to be sitting there and one day get the taker, come across their desk, and fall in love with those characters, and then find out she's got 2 more. That's their dream day, right? And that's what they would die for. So just think of it that way, that there's someone out there. You don't have to have everybody in the world love your book. As my friend Brad Park said after a panel at the Dream Festival book, you don't have to have everyone in America love you to be a bestseller. You just need 5%. 5% of America follow your book. The 95, other 95% could hate you. So all those people just go out and buy every book you ever write. And then
I don't know how it works. And it's all changed, right? So one thing I will say is this was picked by the American Library Association as one of the top 10 debut novels of last year. It actually was almost bought by Knopf. That's what it came down to. Right, I know. Knopf. And
think about what your cover would be.
I know. I just... The Night Circus. That was the competition. So, I mean, not the Night Circus. The Last Werewolf was the competition at the bidding time. Yeah, it's really interesting what you see behind the things. And the CEO of Stein & Schuster read this book and loved it. So, and she didn't read every book. So I have to say, I mean, I try not to... I think it really is just an incredible read, unless you're really kind of tender-hearted and you don't like cuss words or whatever. There's not a lot of cuss words, but there is a lot of sex. I think you'll find it interesting. I wanted to write a book that was not a formulaic book, that wasn't... Doesn't it drive you crazy? You read a book and it's like, oh my God.
I read this before.
Disney could have written this one. The character arc is the same. The character's the same. You just put, you know, just a little cardboard. I hate that. I wanted a book that would, like, transport people. And that's what I tried to write. And so I just want people to read it.
I really encourage you to give it a try, because I found it fascinating, even though at the end I was like, this is not horror.
Where's the conspiracy?
But neither were the other 3 writers on the panel, so we had a really fun time. But everyone
it was
writing
fun.
Fiction, and yeah. they were all interesting people, so I think that's what we found to bring us together. So, and she's going to be here to chat.
Sure.
Do you have a question?
With a multi-genre book, do you deliberately target different sort of markets that you think you can, in other words, rather than try to mix them together, do you simply say, get it published wherever, and then just go after it, whatever your market is, or the mystery market? I mean, you want to hit the romance market because you have elements of that. Just pitch and see what happens. Tell me, how's that? What is your strategy?
I think it would really come down quite a bit to the book you have. Like I said, this particular book, when editors read it, they didn't have a problem with it. They thought it would appeal to people who liked The Time Traveler's Wife or The Passage or A Discovery of Witches, even though those are all very different books. If you see what I mean, it's kind of like that big fiction book that has that supernatural element to it. So for them, it wasn't a matter of, well, we'll try to hit the romance crowd. That's just come after the fact. But I can see where you might have a book that's, you know, half thriller, half steampunk, and then they might have to make the choice. Are we going to go more towards the thriller audience, or are we going to go more towards the sci-fi fantasy audience? But it would really just come down to what the book says, you know, when you read it.
And then I think also you're going to have an issue where even if your book is very mysterious and very romantic, if they decide to just treat it with a, you know, romance cover, how many of the, you know, other folks are you going to get? Are they willing to pick up a book with that cover? You know, that kind of thing. You see, reading it.
Yeah, I'm not picturing a lot of men walking into the Barnes & Noble buying that book.
We could have a cover for them.
We could
have a different cover, yeah.
How about books and then
maybe on Kindle?
Pick your own cover. That's great.
A whole stack of covers, like greeting cards, right? I'm not an author, but here's the cover.
That's brilliant, actually.
Or just paper covers, the cover on the back.
Right. Yeah. Choose your cover.
Choose your cover.
Choose your own adventure.
What are three covers? Pick one.
That is a good idea.
All right. Let's go. John, your next book. Three covers.
Your cover. Exactly. Well, thank you all
so much.
Thank you.